I want to begin today by inviting you to reflect on the ups and downs, the highs and lows of this past year. I know that will take a little doing, so I'll move slowly here at first. And I know that as you're thinking back over a full year of life and experience, it's impossible to fit all of that into a single word. But I wonder what would happen if I give you a short list of words. See if any of these work. If you had to choose one, which word best captures what this past year has felt like for you? So just some words, okay? Anxious, peaceful, fearful, joyful, stressed, excited, sad, angry, curious, bored. That's probably enough, and you don't have to, I didn't ask you to raise your hand. You didn't have to sign up for any of those, and you don't have to say which one feels like what your life has felt like unless you want to. But I do want to ask, are there other words as you thought about what this past year has felt like for you? Are there other words that came to mind for you that I didn't mention? I'd love to hear them if that was the case. Fast. Okay, very good. Interesting. Anything else? Blessed. Growth. Diet. Okay, and then enlightening. Enlightening. I like it. Challenging. Very good. All that to say, we come in here all with a year under our belts, but those years felt very different because we all come in here with different kinds of experiences. The full cycle of a year carries us, of course, through the four seasons, back around full cycle to where we started. And every year has its rhythms, and this past year certainly had its rhythm for you and for your family. We go, and then we rest. We work, then we rest. We engage, get involved. We back off, we rest. We need time for retreat and reflection. You all know this. It comes out in some of the language you use for the year. We can't keep charging forward all the time. You can't drive in fifth gear all the time. It won't work. We need time to pause, time to take inventory, time to ask ourselves large questions, to survey what has happened, what has come our way, and to ask ourselves in the midst of all that, how am I doing? What does it feel like to be me? To ask ourselves some big, sometimes challenging questions about the status of our hearts in the midst of all this change. Christ the King Sunday is the final day of a year of worship. This Sunday brings our year of worship together full circle, and it offers us a moment to stop and rest and pause and reflect before we go charging on into the busy season of Advent and Christmas. Sometimes we need simple, clear, kindergarten-level teaching. And this day of the liturgy, Christ the King, is one of those times. The wisdom of the church through the centuries is that on the final day, in a full year cycle of worship, we let ourselves be reminded of this big, beautiful truth, that the living Christ is among us as the King of all creation. His voice is the voice that directs our lives like none other. The living Christ, the one raised from the dead, now reigns within the world in a strange, surprising, and often hard to detect way. And the biggest question for all of us is whether we can be aware enough to taste and touch and smell and hear and see this new kingdom, this new order, this new way of being together with other people. John's gospel provides us with one of the traditional readings for this Sunday. Jesus has been arrested. He's been tried already by the Jewish authorities. He's now been taken before Pontius Pilate. Pilate is the Roman governor of Judea. He's the most powerful representative of Rome, which is the most powerful empire on earth. Pilate's job is to make sure that no one causes any trouble. His job is to make sure everyone in the empire recognizes that there is no king but Caesar. Pilate is no Jew. He says so. He has little interest in Jewish matters or Jewish religion or Jewish worship or Jewish law. But he interrogates Jesus regarding the claims that the Jewish authorities are making against him. In this interchange, Jesus does not appear to be all that respectful. Jesus does not appear to be very nervous either. Pilate is the one who comes off looking fearful. It's Pilate who's afraid of something new coming to birth within the law and order of the Roman Empire. It's Pilate who cannot hear any voice but Caesar's call for obedience. But Jesus claims that his new, big, beautiful kingdom is so secure that his followers need not use force or violence to defend it. His followers recognize him by listening for the sweetness, the tenderness, the kindness, and the mercy in his voice as he leads them. The reading from Revelation is the early church's confession, probably early second century or so, the early church's confession that the empire of Jesus Christ, crucified and risen, will outlast the Roman Empire and any other empire you can name. This living Christ is and was and always will be the true and proper king of all creation. Everything finds its home in him. Unless we comfort ourselves this morning by saying, well, yeah, sure, whatever. Jesus is a wonderful spiritual guide, but when you get down to stuff that really matters, like war and the economy and policy, well, we follow different rules and different rulers. Well, the confession of the early church is that the living Christ even rules over all the rulers of the earth. In other words, it is the mission of all earthly rulers to direct those under their care as best they can towards this new world of love and justice and healing and compassion coming to birth now within the regular old ordinary world. This lively news of Christ's ongoing authority in our lives is good news. It can reorient and redirect us when we are confused. It can energize us when we lose heart. It can reassure us when we become fearful and overwhelmed. If only we could pry open our hearts to trust in this fragile, small, quiet revolution of love that is always happening right under our noses. Like Pilate, we waffle and dither. We close ourselves down to the real questions of life. We seek to stay in control at all costs. We fear losing what we have. And we give heed to voices that do not tell us the truth. We fail to follow the only voice that can lead us through all the challenges of life, which is the voice of God's love, God's quiet way of sustaining and helping, God's solidarity with anyone who needs help. We fail to register the voice of the King, who is also always the Good Shepherd, leading the sheep to water and pasture and rest. Like the congregations of Christians in Asia, those were the original recipients of that letter we know as Revelation. We wither in fear before powerful political challenges to our faith. We wilt sometimes like flowers. We lose steam and we opt for a soft and comfortable life, tired of fighting with powerful ideas and powerful people. and powerful rulers whose voice is nothing, nothing like the voice of the living Christ who is here in our midst. We allow ourselves to be worn down by the battering voices around us that can only lead us into a spiral of living death. But even in our unbelief, our flagging energy, our failure, and our betrayal, Christ the King continues to welcome us into this new community, inviting us to share again the meal of grace with sisters and brothers that are all different shapes and sizes and colors, people who have no business sharing their lives together other than the fact that they have all heard this beautiful, alluring, persuasive voice calling them to something new and better and different. On the backside of your bulletin, there's an image. It's a little bit dark, but there's an image of the Last Supper painted by Leonardo da Vinci. In the 1490s, the Duke of Milan, Ludovico Sforza, hired da Vinci to paint this scene of the Last Supper on the north, what would be the north wall of the new dining hall in an elegant little church and monastery in the heart of Milan. By this point in his life, Leonardo was well known as all kinds of things, a painter just being one of them. But he was so famous in Milan that as he began this project that lasted most of the 1490s, crowds would gather each day to watch him work. Some days he would climb the scaffolding and paint all day without anything to eat or drink and never come down until evening. Other days, Leonardo would climb up, stare at the painting for a couple of hours, do nothing, and then leave. Just confuse the crowds, of course. Sometimes he would run into the monastery, scramble up the scaffolding, and apply only a brushstroke or two to one of the figures, and then suddenly leave for the day. His goal in this project was to paint something new. He wanted to capture the drama and the action of this scene, which was frequently painted in that period. Leonardo's picture was not to be a frozen snapshot, something still and lifeless. He wanted to convey both the motion and the emotion of the scene. That's why he painted the scene in a way that emphasizes the gestures and the bodily movements of all the figures in the scene. And the moment that he captures is the moment just after Jesus has said to his disciples, "One of you will betray me." Boom, that's the scene he captures. One of you will betray me. And so we can see in the disciples the frenzy and the worry and the agitation and the self-defense that I would imagine will feel familiar to most of us. Because we too live in the tension between wanting to follow Jesus and wanting nothing to do with him. Leonardo captures the moment just before the disciples discover the identity of the one who will betray Jesus, but now we know, of course, who the betrayer is, right? It's you and me. In the Bible and in this painting, of course, it's Judas who represents this betrayal on our behalf. If you want to know, Judas is third to your left of Jesus. He's darker because he's meant to be painted in a shadow, sort of recoiling a bit from Jesus. He's holding a small bag of coins in his right hand and reaching for the bread with his left. The wonder of da Vinci's painting is the wonder of our lives, that the King of all creation refuses to give up on us in our repeated betrayals, that the living Christ keeps inviting us back to the table, even knowing all we've done and all we've left undone, that our failures to follow and serve him only result in amplifying and increasing God's grace towards us. Friends, we have much to be thankful for, but today we can be thankful for the beautiful, graceful, tenacious voice of the living Christ that never ceases calling us into the way of abundance, sharing, joy, and gratitude. We give thanks for this life-shaping news that is elusive and hard to grasp, that we are loved beyond measure, and so is everyone else. What we celebrate is that this newness is not merely an otherworldly idea, an abstract principle. No, we celebrate the arrival of this newness right in the middle of our ordinary world, right in the middle of our ordinary lives. It's the presence of the new within the old that makes our celebration, our joy, and our faith so confusing to so many of our friends. When we gather, as we do today, to share communion, we do so in a way as early adopters, celebrating ahead of time and on behalf of all others the biblical story of abundance and gifts. So I'll end today with language from Diana Butler Bass's book on gratitude. Quote, "That's what the church is intended to be, a festive community dependent on gifts of abundance. Everything is a gift. Bread is a gift. Wine is a gift. Life and joy are gifts. No one can ever pay them back. God never withholds. All we can do is receive. In awe of such favor and grace, say thank you to the giver, and then pay it forward with humble service to others." Amen.